I'm going to wait until this starts uploading, and I'm going to switch to the guide of the course. Where is that? Yeah, let me see. This is the generic guide. Maybe in the, I just wanted to direct you where you had this information. Okay, here you go. RP accents. Okay, very good. Okay, so in the study guide, I'm recapping some of the things that I said before I pressed record. In the study guide, I would like to direct you to the Variaciones Fonético-Fonológicas page in the UNED campus. If you're on your computers, you can probably open another tab. Check that out while you continue listening to me. I would direct you to the study guide. And if you go to the section that's Plan de Trabajo, it talks about the contents in depth. And as you can see, the first thing that we're going to see is that there's going to be exercises geared to making you understand better how English sounds. That's very difficult to replicate in this environment, because if I play a file for the students here, the students online can't listen, and there's no way of sharing for the moment URLs in the virtual course, so it makes it more difficult to share sounds. So I'm going to try to devise a way. What I did in previous courses was send the students certain links to work on during the week, so you became familiar with those sounds, and that should cover that gap. But I understand that it's one of the shortcomings of the environment that we're in. I don't have the 18 of you in a classroom, and therefore it's a bit more difficult to make all of you be aware of the auditive information. Even however, I'm going to need to use part of these exercises here in class to illustrate what I'm talking about as we advance in the course. Phonetical transcriptions are going to be very important. You're going to be expected to know several styles or several collections of phonemes from different varieties, and that's what we're going to cover over the following weeks. This is for today, no? No. It is. Let me see if I have the one for today. Where is it? Oh my God. Ah, here. So, the first thing that we have to do is cover the accents of the British Isles. In the second unit, after we cover the generalities of the introduction, we're going to go over the English accents of the British Isles, and the work plan gives a very, very important indication that you should probably start to plan from day one, from today. At the end of the course, you have to command four accents, four. So you have to be able to manage RP English, which is the de facto standard, and I've been talking before that if you aren't familiar with RP accent, I would recommend you the previous version, not the current version of Eva Esteva's book, Teach Yourself English Pronunciation, which is a fantastic book for brushing up on RP English. And I think with that book, you're really set, and you don't need to manage any more material to get up to speed in terms of RP English. Thankfully, you guys have an American teacher, so General American is going to be part of the territory that is going to be amply covered. One of the two video conferences that I'm going to carry out is on General American, and the other one is on Southern Irish English. So how do we choose the other two accents? Is that something that I can freely do? No, it's very specific. It's not any other of the rest of the accents of the world. It's two groups. The first of the accents that you have to choose between the different accents of the British Isles that are not RP English. So taking out all the English accents that are not RP, we're going to have to focus on a secondary British accent from Welsh English, Scottish English, and Southern Irish English. That means that Northern Irish English is not an accent that you can choose. It's an optional accent. You can learn about it. You can study about it, but it's not part of the exam material. You're not going to be questioned about that. You're going to be asked to represent either Welsh English, Scottish English, or Southern Irish English. The second one is from the Englishes of the Southern Hemisphere. From the Southern Hemisphere, we have three accents: Australian English, South African English, and West Indian English. Wow. So what do you do with these accents? My personal recommendation for your third accent, your accent from the British Isles, think about your personal experience. Who have you met throughout your life when you were learning English? What type of teachers did you have? Did you happen to have a Scottish teacher? Did you happen to spend a summer in Wales? Do you like the course and you've been listening to Irish, English half of your life? I don't know. Whatever the case, go in that direction. So from the British Isles, I would say play it safe and probably don't experiment a new accent if you're already familiar to another one. And that would be the recommendation I would make to all of you, to try to come to the accent where you feel comfortable and is within your comfort zone. About the accents of the Southern Hemisphere, I can only give you one very clear recommendation. Unless you're very good with Australian English, the best way to play it safe is to choose South African English. It's a no-brainer. The South African English is the one that is the most similar variety to RP English in terms of the phonemes that you have to learn and the transcription similarities. So if you feel lost saying, how am I going to choose between Australian English, Southern African English, and West Indian English, I really don't know if I'm familiar with any of those. You probably are not extremely familiar, but South African English is, let's say, more understandable for people that have been highly exposed to British English, which is the majority of Spanish students. Let's face it, Spanish students normally study under British rules, British textbooks, Anglophilic environments where Cambridge testing systems and Oxford testing system are much more frequent than American systems. So in that case, South African English makes much more sense being practical than Australian English or West Indian English. But feel absolutely free to choose whichever one fits your personal profile better. Four accents: RP English, General American, one of the accents of the British Isles, and one of the accents of the Southern Hemisphere. That leaves us with the question, what about Canadian English? Canadian English is frequent. Canadian English is so similar to General American that for the sake of simplicity, it's been left out. The accent that we study here, General American, is like a mix and match of different accents. It's not actually an accent that is the most widespread accent, but it's the most widely studied, the General American. It's normally considered and called GA. Let me write that down. Okay, so the four things you would have to study would be General American, RP English, British Isles, excluding Northern Irish English, This would be out of the mix. And here, Canadian English would be out of the mix, as well as all the other types of American English and Southern Hemisphere. Southern Hemisphere. Okay? From the three that we're talking about, the three mainstream. So we're going to omit, of course, New Zealand English, any type of English from India or from Pakistan. It's going to be excluded. Only the West Indies, which is the area of Jamaica and the territories in the Caribbean. Very peculiar type of English. You have to feel very, very confident in your knowledge to assume that, but if that's the case, embrace it and enjoy it. I would never choose that if I were in your case. South African English, or Australian English. And I don't know if you have any questions about this set of, you have any preferences here? Maybe you can write about, and feel free to ask any type of information that you may need decide on these accents. Do you know, Elena, which one you're going to choose?
I was thinking about taking an Australian
path. Okay. I mean, if you're a huge Hugh Grant and fan and you love Chris Hemsworth and you've listened to hours and hours of interviews and you feel familiar with that type of English, go for it. The good thing is that you don't have to decide until the same moment you take your exam. Okay, so you can test the waters with two accents in that case.
Peter, I
think
that I would choose
Irish. Southern Irish English would be always my favorite choice. If I struggle to understand any type of a fellow English speaking native citizen, it's always been Scottish English. Scottish is more similar in transcription and phonemes to Spanish. So if you're very good, for example, with phonetics in Spanish, maybe it makes sense for you to choose Scottish. I would never choose it because I understand Scottish, Irish people better than I understand English people. So for me, Southern Irish English would be my number one choice, and that's where I would head. Welsh English is similar to other varieties of the British Isles. And let me take this moment to open one of these files and test if they've changed the way we can share. How would I say that? If we can share URLs. Let's see if they've changed that in the new tweaks that they've done here. Which of the British Isles symbols are more similar to RP? I would probably say Southern Irish English or Welsh English. Las hojas? No? Okay. Oh, thank you. Let me see. Oh, it does let me share a URL. I don't know if it's linkable. No, you probably have to copy that. That is the first link on this document that I have open here. Unit 1 Theory, Sound Comparison. If I open that file, and I'm going to open it here for your classmates to see, this is a really cool interactive sound database because it has, when I opened this at home, it was in English. It says Englishes. So it lets you use, why is this in Spanish? Ah, look, it's here. Okay, so represent in English. Okay, so it's going to say a word and we're going to get the transcription. And if I go, for example, close to Birmingham, I don't have a sound for that. Gotcha. That would be London. That would be Wales. Scottish. Northern Irish. Southern Irish. So as you can see, the transcription itself shows you the real challenge of this subject. There's going to be a huge amount of variety. What are we going to have to focus on? We're going to have to focus on the general, of the generalities, of the variation of each language. It's impossible to study a variety in 4 months. It's just impossible. Not four, one. It's impossible. Because, first of all, varieties don't actually even exist. I mean, I speak my idiolect, and Almudena speaks hers, and Asunción speaks hers, and Javier speaks his, and the 14 of you that are connected online speak yours. Each of us have a way of speaking English that if we were speaking in an English-speaking country, it would be similar to my neighbors, to my family, to the people around me. But two neighborhoods away, one of the words would be slightly different. And three cities away, some of the words, some of the verbs would be pronounced different. I mean, you only have to travel to, for example, Murcia, or for example, Bilbao or Galicia, to notice that that happens in Spanish in the same way. What is the difference? That in the British Isles, the differences are extreme and incredible from the north to the south. There is a big continuum of accents, and there's a registration of an enormous amount of varieties of English. Here it is, the ones they take are RP English, for example. I don't know if I can locate that. Okay, here. So in this sound comparison website, I'm able to choose the type of English that I want to listen to and see the phonetic representation. If you see the phonetic representation here, there are going to be some symbols that are going to differ from the representation that you're used to from when you study phonetics. Keep it simple. There is a lot of variety between one ways of transcribing and others. To play it safe, my recommendation would always be to use Silvia Barreiro. Silvia Barreiro is the director of this subject and the professor of this subject and the person that corrects most of your exams and designs the examinations. Follow the instructions that she gives in these documents that she's posted. In my opinion, Silvia Barreiro's documents, if she extended them a bit more and maybe got some recordings, are even better than the Trudgel and Hannah's books. A book. I've insisted a couple of times to Silvia that she should probably write the book, find time. I know she's very busy. She's got a managerial position in Adunet, but she should find time sooner or later to write a book that supersedes this one, because but quite frankly, the book is okay.
It's interesting to read.
It's
interesting
to read. It's very spread out, and the presentation of the information makes absolutely no sense. I've been unable to find the priority of... Exactly. It reminds me very much to a social linguistics book, because it goes from English to Australasian to South African and Welsh English. What is the connection there? I mean, I really can't find a connection to why those varieties are grouped together. The pronunciation of North America, chapter 3. English in North America, grammatical, orthographical, and lexical differences. So it goes RP English and American English, which is probably the most important topic. It leaves it in the fourth chapter. I really don't understand this distribution. Scottish and Irish English are set apart, and they're part of Unit 5. West Indian and English-based Creoles, Unit 6. Lesser-known English is Unit 7. Second language varieties of different types, such as Singaporean English, English in the Philippines, Fiji English, etc. So, using this as a textbook is going to be a bit of a choose-your-own-adventure type of story. My recommendation, read Silvia Barreiro's documents top-down, and when Silvia Barreiro says, go to page this and this of Trudgel and Hannah and read this section and this section, do that. Okay, that's the way you should go around, okay? Without further ado, let's get into the contents of the first introductory unit. Let me look for my copy here, but it is really difficult to read from the screen all the time. My notes fell on the ground today and they're all mixed up, so it's kind of, here it is. Unit 1. Okay, so from this moment on, I'm going to move to the board, and I'll try to speak loud so the guys that are at home, the people that are at home can still listen to me. As I said, regarding the four accents that you choose, you don't have to communicate in any moment which language, which varieties you choose. I don't know if they normally don't publish the PEC at the beginning of the course, but let's check. No, it's not published. I'll try to find out when the PEC is due to start. Due to be submitted. It's normally mid-March? Mid-April? Probably mid-April. And I'll let you know probably in the next class when I've spoken to Sylvia, because I see Sylvia every week. I'll try to get back to you with these type of answers. I'm seeing that the document that I have and the one that's in the virtual course has changed a bit. Okay, well, I'll navigate around that. In the first unit, it talks about the first information that it gives. Okay, let me see. Try to move this to this side. The first information it gives is information about what to read from Prudhoe and Hannah. Pages 1 to 8 of both editions. Okay, so it's trying to give a page note, the models of English of the world. And I'm going to use the older version because I have my notes here. So what we're going to refer to is what we would call standard English. Standard English is sort of a social convention, and when we talk about RP, we don't talk about something that we actually hear a lot of people speaking, unless we're tuning into BBC, or unless we're watching Peppa Pig, or Ben Holly, or
Bobo Young. They don't have their language as in Spain.
They don't?
Standard English. So it seems that they don't laugh their language. Because
they laugh.
They laugh.
Laugh? That's amazing. I love. They don't love their language. I think that the problem that English has, and it's a problem that it's had for centuries, is that nobody is an authority. In Spain, you have one authority. You have the Real Academia de la Lengua, and there is no Real Academia in any country around English. So what happens? Normally, dictionary makers and prestigious universities are the only institutions in charge of pushing forward English and doing two things that is a very dangerous thing to do at the same time. Because Spanish, for example, is absolutely descriptive. It's not prescriptive. Spanish gives you the common set of rules, but if something changes because vulgarisms are included into the language, it accepts it, it creates a new orthography, new grammar, and it publishes that. In English, that doesn't happen. Oxford says one thing, Cambridge says something different, Western America says one thing, Macmillan says another thing. So that variety create a set of tensions for me to see this question over here. Is that an English BBC English? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. RP English is BBC English. What we would say what traditionally BBC English has been, because it's true that previous to the turn of the century and for the last years, BBC has been much more open to other accents. Before you couldn't work for BBC if you weren't able to absolutely replicate RP English sounds. If you couldn't speak RP English, you couldn't be on the news, you couldn't be present in a program, you could at the most be interviewed in a news segment. Any presenter and an anchor had to speak RP English. The British Council, which is a public and private institution of Great Britain, has put forward a lot of money to ensure that the younger generation speak something similar to RP English. They've done it through cartoons. They financed and funded three very, very successful TV programs, Pocoyo, Peppa Pig, and Ben and Polly. The purpose of those series, and even though this sounds very trivial, it's very true, is for English children to not be absolutely bombarded by American English, which is the dominant variety in media, on television, TV series, and movies. So, RP English is a fabrication. Yes, it's a fabrication. Very few people, or we could say nobody, speaks pure RP English, especially not in the British Isles. People speak the English of where they're from. And RP English is similar to a certain type of Southeastern English that was considered nobly and upper class, and therefore it was taken as golden standard. That was the reason why they chose that. They chose it for that purpose. Okay, so the reason why they chose RP English above other varieties was to use it as the golden standard, the measure against which to compare all the rest of the Englishes. So the book says, standard English is a kind of English that this book is written in. There is nothing surprising about this. Books, newspaper, magazines, and nearly everything else that appears in print in the English-speaking world are written in standard English. So we have not chosen to write this book in standard English because we think it is better than other varieties of English, or because it is more expensive or clearer, expressive or clearer, or more logical than other varieties. It isn't. There is quite simply a social convention which our publisher is keen for us to maintain that books are not written in any variety of English other than standard English. This type of English is called standard because it has undergone standardization, which means that it has this technical process through which it has been selected, codified, and stabilized in a way that other varieties have not. In the case of certain other languages, selected might mean that an official decision was made at some point for one particular dialect of language to receive the standardization treatment. As opposed to any of the others, this is not what happened with English. Standard English acquired its status much more gradually and in a more organic way. The ancestor of modern standard English developed in and around the royal court in London, among the aristocracy and ruling elite. Because the elite were concentrated in London, this pre-standard English was a dialect of a predominantly London area type. So what we understand nowadays is RP English is, in its origin, a subtype of London English. But because it was associated with a group of people who were mixed, of mixed geographical origins and who were unusually mobile and well-traveled, this court dialect shows signs from the very earliest records that we have of being a mixed dialect. For example, the language of the proclamation of Henry III, a text written as early as 1258, shows a blending of Midland and Southern features. And the form of language which eventually emerged over the centuries as a preferred way of writing among the governing class had features which were not only Southeastern in origin, but also Southern and Midland, particularly East Midland. And of course, the dialect was from the very beginning an upper social class dialect which was not associated with the common workers and peasants. therefore, and there's a footnote that I'm making. Standard English is a sign of power, status, and prestige. Okay? So this is very important for English to prove through its selected style that it is a prestigious selection. It is a selection of high status, and it is a selection that indicates power. You're going to hear your ruling class speak in this variety. It is the intended selection. So no committee were involved in deciding which dialect of English was to be standardized. The upper classes quite naturally wrote in their own dialect, and then were in a position to impose this way of writing in their society at large. This was rather widely accepted because the variety was associated with power and status and had considerable prestige. I'm going to read from a couple of lines below. Standard English is probably not the native dialect of more than about 50% of the population of England. And reflecting standard English's social origins, most of that 50% will be concentrated towards the top end of the social scale. So that standard English is still quite clearly a social dialect, something which is true to a greater or lesser extent of all the English-speaking countries. Things that I want to mention about these first pages, I want to go over the 5 points that are below. To give some ideas of how standard English differs from other non-standard dialects of the language, we can point out that because of its history and special status, standard English has a number of grammatical peculiarities which distinguish it from most other varieties. These include, standard English does not distinguish between the past tense forms of the auxiliary verb to do and those of the main verb to do. The past tense form in standard English is did in both cases. You did it, did you? But in most non-standard dialects all over the English-speaking world, did is the past tense of the auxiliary, but the main verb has the past tense form done. You done it, did you? I don't agree fully with Crutchfield and his conclusions, but I'm going to leave it at that. There is a point of discrepancy that I personally have in this book, but I'm going to leave you to analyze if that is coincidental with your personal experience. One of the things that I want to improve this year over what I've done other years, and I found the students to be lacking more training in that aspect. From the very beginning, I'm going to try to bring transcriptions to the class, so we practice similar scenarios to the ones you're going to find in the PEC and the ones you're going to find in the final exam, so you feel prepared. And examples of the type of questions that we get, so you're able to distinguish easier what type of information is really relevant from what we have to read. I recommend you reading all of it. And what information is, let's say, a bit more secondary. Number two, standard English does not have the grammatical feature which is called negative concord. In most non-standard varieties, negative forms agree grammatically with one another throughout the clause, as in, I couldn't find none nowhere, where all the words that can take a negation form do so. In standard English, grammatical agreement or concord of this type has not occurred. I couldn't find any anywhere. Standard English has an irregular way of forming reflexive pronouns, with some forms based on the possessive pronouns, myself, yourself, ourselves, yourselves, and others based on the object pronouns, themselves, themselves. Many non-standard dialects have a regular system using possessive forms throughout, myself, yourself, his self, ourselves, yourselves, theirselves. Standard English has the regular past forms of the verb to be, distinguishing between singular and plural, something which does not happen with other verbs. I was, he was, but we were, they were. Most non-standard dialects have the same form for singular and plural. I was, she was. We was, you was, they was. For I was, you were, we were, you were, they were. I don't know if I agree with that fully. For many irregular verbs, standard English redundantly distinguishes between past tense and perfect verb form by using distinct past tenses and past participle forms, as well as an auxiliary verb have. I have seen him, I could have gone, versus I saw him, I went. Many other dialects have no distinction between the past tense and the past participle, and rely on the presence versus absence of have alone. I have seen him, I could have went, versus I see him, I went. Oh my God. Things that I want to I want to focus. There is a description of the models of English, and I'm really going to need that for you to read, because I think that it goes into the design of this book and how the information is distributed, about what information is important. The information on page 5 is about the models of English, and page 5, 6, and 7. And the way that we're going to refer to English in this book is English. Okay, so there's going to be away from the computer, the sound is really bad. Yeah, I know. I'm going to try to speak louder, and I'm going to try to get closer. Okay? Okay, so the models of English, from the models of English, I want to read.
English here is
RB English. It's similar. Let me read from that part. From the end of page 5, the end of page 5 says, as far as pronunciation is concerned, because what we've been speaking as standard English is the way of writing. Now let's talk about the way of speaking. As far as pronunciation is concerned, it means something much more restrictive for the RP, received pronunciation accent. Page 5 at the end of page 5. As far as grammar and vocabulary are concerned, the next way is far. As far as pronunciation is concerned, I'm going to start in the other as far, because it indicates what you were asking, the difference between standard English and RP English. As far as grammar and vocabulary are concerned, this generally means that standard English, as it is normally written and spoken by educated speakers in England, and with certain differences in Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. And there comes my reluctancy to what the conclusions are, because it considers standard English very far away from other varieties of English, such as American English. And I'm really not sure that the difference is as big as it's described by this author in particular. As far as pronunciation is concerned, it means something much more restrictive for the RP, received pronunciation accent, which is taught to foreigners, is actually used by perhaps only 3 to 5% of the population of England. You found it as a new?
Yes.
Okay. And by more or less nobody anywhere else. That's why I said nobody speaks RP English. Okay? BBC speaks RP English, but what you were saying before. Like standard English, the RP accent has its origins in the southeast of England, but it is currently a social accent associated with the BBC, the public schools in England, and with members of the upper middle and upper classes. It is true, and it also has a history of having considerable prestige in the whole of the British Isles and the British Commonwealth. So, to explain it a certain way, RP English is a pronunciation that is exported from the British Isles to the rest of the world as their gift to the world for people to learn English. If you have to learn how to pronounce in English, pronounce in RP, because you're going to do a good job. Everybody's going to understand you, or at least all the rest of the foreigners are going to understand you, because we're teaching the same thing to everybody else. It would make little sense for some schools to teach in Irish English, others to teach in Scottish English, others to teach in English from Liverpool, others from English from London. So I do understand the necessity of standardizing all the incredible amount of variety that the British Isles have in one single flavor, in that art English. And it represents the pronunciation of a standard English. So let's notice that difference. Standard English, a way of writing, art English, a way of pronouncing. Okay, that would be, in a nutshell, way of explaining it. In this book, we shall refer to the combination of British standard English grammar and vocabulary with the RP accent as English English. Okay? So that is a combination of both English rather than British English. The other form of standard English that is widely taught to students of English as a foreign language and English as a secondary language is the one we shall refer to as North American English, meaning English as it is written and spoken by educated speakers in the United States of America and Canada. Therefore, this RP English is supra-loaded by its way of speaking and writing. English, English, okay? So this would refer to this, and I think it's N-A-M, right? I never remember that. Yes. N-A-M. Standard, also called Queen English. Well, that would make sense. Quite frankly, it would make all the sense in the world because ever since we've listened to kings and queens speak in English, it would make sense for them to speak a dialect that's very similar to RP English because that's the dialect that has been spoken in court for a very long time. And the royalty of all the royals have been more exposed to RP English than the rest. It would make all the sense in the world. I've never heard that expression, or I don't recall hearing that expression, but basically, these are going to be the references that I'm going to make to English, and I want you to understand that whenever I write English English, it's a parallel to RP English, okay? And it's a parallel to the standard English. North American English represents General American in terms of the sound. The GA and the RP refer to sound. The NAM ing and the A ing refer to the whole set. Other things that I would like to read from here. The spread of English is part of the, I'm going to read it because I really like this part. I'm going to read the beginning of the spread of English even though, the unit is telling us to, read, only up to the spread of English, because I think it gives a very interesting overview of the way that English developed. The English language developed out of Germanic dialects, I'm on page 8 of the book, that were brought to Britain during the course of the 5th and 6th centuries by the Jutes from modern Jutland in Denmark, Angles from modern Schleswig in Denmark and Germany, Saxons from modern Holstein in Germany, and Frisians from modern Friesland in the Netherlands and Germany. By medieval times, this Germanic language had replaced the original Celtic or Celtic, both ways are valid of calling it Celtic or Celtic, language of Britain in nearly all of England, as well as in southern and eastern Scotland. Until the 1600s, however, English remained a language spoken by a relatively small number of people in the world and was confined geographically to the island of Britain. Indeed, even much of Britain remained non-English speaking. The original Celtic language of Britain survived in the form of Welsh in nearly all of Wales and as Cornish in much of Cornwall. The highlands and islands of western and northern Scotland spoke Gaelic, another Celtic language, which had been brought across from Ireland in pre-medieval times. and the population of Northern Ireland, Orkney and Shetland still spoke the Scandinavian language, Norn, which they had inherited from their Viking ancestors. It was not until the 17th century that the English language began the geographical and demographic expansion, which has had led to the situation in which it finds itself with more non-native speakers than any other language in the world, and more native speakers than any other language except Chinese. Exactly. where I find this book a bit chauvinist is how it completely ignores the French influence that is enormous of the language. We all know that the Orange dynasty invaded and conquered what was the British Isles, this area of England, at the turn of the first millennium, around the year 1000. So was that influence very big? Oh my God, the influence was enormous. The vocabulary, most of the military vocabulary, the vocabulary that has to do with royalty, with military rank, with prestige, it has a very strong French and, of course, Latin origin. Places where we can see the influence of French in English is so obvious. For example, in the vous, in the personal pronouns, which is a direct character of the you, and that's why we use the you in second person singular and second person plural, because it is a direct transference from the French vous. Most words have a more Latinized and a more anglicized a word, such as regal, which is absolutely French, and royal, which has an absolute French sense as well. We see that at the same time, there is a word that has a Germanic king or kingdom. We're always going to find words that already existed and words that were added. That happens with home instruments, kitchenware, any hardware or tools used for construction, and military words. The old structure of the language was deeply influenced by Latin and by this French information that was in the year 1000 or around the 1000. If you study or if you're going to study history of the English language, it's called the Academia now. My guy Eduardo has a fantastic book. She's excellent at defining that difference between the pre-invasion English and the post-invasion English. And I can only recommend you another one of the fantastic books that we have here some books are not good, but those in particular, Eva Esteva's book and Micah's book are excellent books. So I only want to read that initial part because I really think that it indicates that the author has a certain bias. Okay, I started to clarify when you mentioned it, Asunción, I was going to indicate exactly that. But you might notice the bias that the author has. Because from there, he goes on, and it's very interesting. I recommend you reading it at home, how the expansion of the 1600s led to the two varieties of English. England, when France and Spain lost their naval capacity, expanded in two directions, to the west towards America, and to the east towards Australia, and towards India, and towards Pakistan, and Bangladesh, and the Far East. Those two types of English evolved in a different way, and they are very good examples of the way that English was spoken at a certain point of history, and some places in North America still represent a very representative way of how English was spoken, for example, the place of Shakespeare, and some isolated parts of Australia or New Zealand represent how English was spoken in the 17th century. So they're really interesting and things to study, but the contents of this unit are so enormous that we can't spend too much time with that. But regarding things that we have to take into consideration when we talk about the factors for variability, why languages change from one place to another, and why in the same territory they change so much from one part to the other. One of the factors that we find are personal, and I think it's mentioned here, personal reasons such as age and sex of the speaker. I don't know if you have children, if you have younger brothers or sisters, you probably notice that there are certain words, certain expressions that are generational. Your parents didn't use them, you use them, and the next generation doesn't use them anymore or use different ones, and therefore date yours. That is a process that is happening constantly in languages, and in some cases it can be very noticeable, such as in words, but we're going to see how General American, for example, has an incredible thing that is inherited from Australian English, of all the Englishes in the world. American English is hugely influenced by Australian English. It's something that is called the upspeak. And it's a female predominant way of speaking that English people hate, in particular because it's socially very disruptive with the way that British people speak. You might have heard younger generations of American on television or in programs that speak in affirmative mode as if they were asking questions. So they would talk like this, and they would start to raise their tone as if they weren't very sure of what they were saying. Those intonational patterns have to do with age, and we're going to study that as well, because we're going to focus on the word, we're going to focus on the phoneme, but we're also going to focus on the super segment, on how the different varieties of English express themselves depending on their age range, on their preference for one intonational pattern or other intonational pattern. We're very used to the intonational patterns of RP English, how we rise towards the main verb and how we drop after that. How we rise towards a negative in the case of a negation and how we drop after that. But they're not the only patterns there are in English, and that's what we're going to talk about in the following classes. How well am I doing on time? Well, not that good. We have 15 more minutes to go. I would like to at least cover the introductory part of this document, at least 2 points. The factors that account for the variability can be personal, such as the age of the speaker, younger versus older, and what I mentioned before, men and women. Men speak different to women. It's here in the document. It's the first points. The social class. Some classes speak different to other classes. I'm sure that you notice it in your own language. Spanish is a very good benchmark for many of these ideas. The social class is a great indicator of one way one part of the population speak and the other one. Besides these two primary points, age and social class, we have others that are also relevant. For example, the educational background. I don't know if you have any friends or family that have a lower level or a higher level of education, and you may notice that the way they express themselves is different, and therefore, if those people have family, their family would probably express themselves in a very similar way to their parents, and that creates divides and changes and a dissemination of the way that a language is spoken. The profession or role. Maybe you have a certain way of expressing yourself at work. You have a different way of expressing yourself with friends, or when you're watching a football match, or when you're drinking beers at a bar with your friends. Okay, so the environment, the role that we're taking on at a certain moment is very similar. I remember that I was working for a company where whenever somebody agreed, everybody would say "Fenomenal." It was like the buzzword of the company. And I've never said, and I've done it so many times in my life, as of 3 or 4 years that I worked for that company, because any other way of improving sounded out of place. Because the word that everybody used was phenomenal. It was like a very standard white word that everybody loved. That also an indicator of social class. And so sometimes your work environment, even if you think it's absolutely transparent to the way you express your language, if you self-reflect on the way that you act and communicate at work with your friends, with your family, you will find those nuances, those matices. You will see those small differences that go from one language, from one point of your life to another. The personality. Maybe a speaker avoids vulgarism. Maybe a speaker embraces vulgarisms and spreads as many as they can. It's going to create a very marked difference. What is the vulgarism of the T? And this is a really interesting thing. When we study Southern Irish English, let me change to the board again. I hope that the people at home can hear me well and hear. This is explained at the beginning of phonetics in the first unit of phonetics. It's normally the example that we explain to introduce allophones. I can hear you well. Very good. Thank you very much. And the difference, the different realizations of put, when we study allophones, there are two types of allophones, and this is really not relevant for you, for the course, because it's a refresher. The allophones can indicate, a different realization of the same phoneme, and they're in complementary position, like for example, the L in light and the L in milk, and how one is a retroflex and the other one, it's like you're expanding the sound. Another case is on the way people express the word put. So, for example, the majority of people that speak RP English and most other varieties of English would settle for something that is put. But Southern Irish English, for example, has a peculiarity that is very, very noticeable in that it produces a global stop, which is represented as a sort of question mark without a point. And this question mark, or this glottal stop sign, is a complete stop, absence of sound. So, RP English, put, Southern Irish English, put, with a stop, an intentional stop, in the sound, the glottal stop. So,
the vowel is not up, put.
No, put.
But the vowel in the transcription is this symbol, it's not up, but.
Really? Oh, yeah.
It's
similar to that. It's not a clear cut.
This is the symbol.
Yeah, this is
what? It's an up. Or it's like a...
It's not a clear
I mean, this is one of the shortcuts that I have as an American English speaker. Which one would you represent?
The single, this one is called.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's definitely. You would say?
Yeah, exactly.
No,
it's what I think, but I don't know.
No,
you're the teacher, sorry.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, I'm a teacher, but I am dangerously affected by my American English. So sometimes I do make these mess ups, and I apologize to you for it. You're right. Probably in our English, it's going to be foot more than foot. I would say foot, but you're right. It's probably foot. Okay. Yes. And it makes more sense, in fact, to say in Southern Irish English foot because it's even more foot. So yeah, I would tend to agree with you.
Is that a local song?
It is a local song. Yes. In fact, it is a global stop. Okay? So, the difference is like the global stop for the T in certain environments. Yes. Okay. So, other things that influence the variability. The attitude towards language and to other speakers. The importance that people give to the different accents. The age that someone acquires an accent. For example, I acquired my accent when I was a very small kid, when I was around 4 or 5. I stopped having exposure to most American speakers. When I was 10, I could only speak to my brother in English, and so my English is kind of frozen in time, and afterwards I learned a lot of RP English that has sort of neutralized my American accent. So I don't sound American to Americans, and I don't sound anything but American to British people. So it's a sort of alienation from everywhere. I know that my accent is not very American, and it's American enough to sound American because of the main factor that we have to take into consideration. What's a big distinction between RP English or English English and other forms of English? What's the main difference between RP and general American or Southern Irish? Do you know that?
The main difference.
Yeah, the big difference.
The big?
The accent.
What? There's something, I mean, of course, an ah and an ah, they're different in quality, but there's one thing in particular that makes really important. Exactly. The R, the rhoticity. Yeah, okay, the tapping and the flapping, the butter instead of butter, but especially the R is a really significant element because the rhoticity is always being one of these big elements that are going to set accents apart, okay? So we're going to see some accents that are rhotic, that means that they pronounce the R's, the pre-consonant R's and the final R's, such as in father or ward. Exactly, yes. And those that don't. But this doesn't mean it's only a thing of, for example, South African English or RP English. If we go to America, and it's something that we're going to see, some accents, like for example, if you go to New York, you see that they have a type of non-rhoticity where they say Bridewell. So they don't pronounce those R's, they make like a sort of W sound, and Boston English or New York accent English is more similar in many things to RC English than to general American. So that adds a level of complexity to what we're doing, and it's going to make our work all the more interesting, and I hope that meaningful and learned in terms of what you learn and what you take away from this course. The frequency with which a user or a speaker uses a word. Words that tend to be used less tend to vary less also over time. The feeling of correctness. A speaker may think that the pronunciation of a certain word is... I'm going to take you to the page. The speaker may think that the pronunciation of a certain word is more correct and therefore may try to strive for those. Now, other factors, some factors are personal, the other factors are situational. Okay? So, factors. You have personal ones and situational ones. And quite frankly, it's age, class, and others. All the rest that we've said, all the educational background, profession, personality, attitudes, age, of accent acquisition, frequency, correctness, it's all minute differences. The big ones, the relevant ones, are age and class. Okay, this is going to be the big social work. You really notice when you're in the presence of someone from the upper class versus when you're in the presence of someone of a lower class. You tend to notice that right away in your mother language. The same happens in every single language. There is a very distinct difference. All the rest of the differences are important, but they're secondary. The situational ones, the social relationship between the speaker and the hearer, how well they know each other, they're going to tend to use a different idiolect to when they speak to people that are unknown. So there is a situational factor, the topic, how common they are, how familiar they are, with the topic at hand, where the situation is taking place, and the purposes of the conversation. From here, we're going to go on to talk about the kinds of variability. And from here, I would take into consideration some keywords such as, I really don't want the colors for that. I'm going to go back to this. Probably can change the color, but I'm not going to experiment too much. The English is a varied language, and we have to take into consideration first the regional spread and the social spread, what this regional and social spread is like a sort of a matrix of combinations. It creates dialects. Everything that we speak, all the varieties of English, another way of referring to a variety is a dialect. So I speak one particular dialect. You guys as learners speak another dialect. People that live in Liverpool, they speak another dialect. And even within Liverpool, there are different dialects. Okay, so this dialectation. Dialects have grammatical forms that are similar and vocabulary that is similar. There is normally a very clear and distinct relationship between the social and the regional variation. The regional variation at the bottom of the social scale is wider than the regional variation at the top. The people from the upper classes tend to speak more similarly, even if they're far away regionally. Whereas the middle, lower, and lower classes speak very different from one place to another. Okay? A dialect can be spoken with any kind of accent. Accent refers to the pronunciation. Your accent is the way you pronounce English when you speak. So dialect is a collection of words, vocabulary, and uses that you make, and accent is a way that you speak. Okay? Your accent is a way you pronounce English when you speak. Furthermore, the relationship between social and regional variation can also be applied to accents. The higher a person is on the social scale, the less regional marked will be his or her accent. And the less... Yes, it is. It is. Social classes have a very strong effect on the way that the dialect and the accent modifies. Upper classes, it changes very little. Lower classes, it changes very significantly. And I think it's very easy to understand if you look at examples that are very extreme. In England, for example, you have regions that are not very far away. Liverpool and Manchester, or Manchester and London. Yeah, the difference in the accent is just unbelievable.
So people from Andalusia,
You get the same thing, yes. And probably if you speak to the governing class of Andalusia, you will notice less the difference, and there will be a tendency to imitate a more standardized version of the language. And that is something that we notice. That there are some people from Andalusia, for example, that have a very marked Andalusian accent. So that is because it's an intentional choice of the person, of the social group, of how he wants to be accepted by people from other regions. Part of it is intentional, part of it is educational, part of it is through the influence with other people of your same social group. If all of your social group speaks in one way, you tend to replicate. Sometimes we see these mirror effects between brothers. Brothers that use the same words, or that have the same gestures, that have the same type of expressions. Just extend that to a family, a community, a group, a school, a city, or a neighborhood, a city, etc., etc. It's something that is really very deeply tied to what you said, social linguistics. A lot of these topics are very connected to social linguistics. In addition to regional and social accents and dialects, English has different styles, which are used in different social situations. The situational variables mentioned above are responsible for these stylistic feature variations. Changes in pronunciations then are conditioned by speakers' perception of the situation in which they are speaking, especially how formal or informal they feel it to be. In formal situations, speakers tend to articulate more slowly and carefully. Besides, there will be fewer elisions. On the contrary, in informal situations, speakers will be more likely to speak quickly and less carefully, aligning and assimilating individual sounds according to the context. I have to say that there is a lot of variety, for example, in this particular case, between, for example, RP English or all the English of the British Isles, and American English. American English follows an absolutely divergent tendency where the boundaries between formal and informal are so blurred that you hear an incredibly informal language being used in the most formal cases. Presidential speeches, diplomatic conversation, university lectures. It is really incredible to see how divergent American English is to the other mainstream variety that is English from England. I'm going to refer to so we can. I'm past the time, but I don't want to. I want to end this last topic. Most differences have to do with words rather than changes in pronunciation. Those words used in very informal situations are often referred to as slang, okay, informal conversation. And finally, the registers are the kinds of language that reflect the abouts of languages. Registers have to do especially with vocabulary. And this specialized vocabulary has a name, the jargon. For example, we use an academic jargon here, but it's different to the jargon that we use if we were, workers at a court of law, or if we were in a production company. The differences which cannot be explained in terms of change over time or speech style, but in terms of speaker preference for one pronunciation over others, are known as free variations. And with that, I'm going to stop there. And in the next class, we're going to focus on transcription and transcription practice, okay? We're going to stop here. I want to thank the enormity of the people that are connected.
Your tip is that we must transcribe.
Yes. Professor Barreiro has put in the forum three documents. Thank you very much. The practice, and I recommend you to really do it and become familiar with the IPA chart.
And,
It's a bit more because there's going to be many new symbols that come into the mix to represent the variation between RP English and the other varieties. Okay? Thank you very much. See you in the next class. I recommend you to do the transcription practice, and I'm going to stop the recording now. Okay, so thanks a lot, everybody. Sorry for...